This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Racism of the powerful, once the stuff of old boy networks and silent oppressive infrastructures, is lately out in the open, but it has a long, sordid history, even in the White House. Consider this conversation between President Richard Nixon and then-California Governor Ronald Reagan, covertly taped by the disgraced president in 1971. The two were discussing a UN vote in which delegates from African countries had gone against American interests, voting to recognize the People's Republic of China, not Taiwan, as the legitimate holder of the UN seat.
Last night, I tell you, to watch that thing on television, as I did.
Yeah.
To see those monkeys from those African countries. Damn them, they're still uncomfortable wearing shoes.
In case you missed that, Reagan called the African delegation monkeys who were uncomfortable wearing shoes. As revealed in The Atlantic last week by presidential historian Tim Naftali, that snippet had for years been withheld by the National Archives, apparently to protect Reagan's privacy, presumably because he was unaware that the conversation was being recorded. To Atlantic staff writer Adam Serwer, Reagan's remark was not only racist and condescending, but emblematic of a certain just-between-you-and-me white supremacism that persists to this day at the highest levels of government and continues to contaminate American democracy. Adam, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Now, one reaction to the recording, and it was mine, was like, duh, is it such a revelation that Reagan ascribed inferiority to blacks?
I don't think it's surprising, but I do think it's important to have on the record, in part because there's a kind of historical amnesia and nostalgia about the extent to which white supremacy has been a governing doctrine of the United States for most of the history of the United States until 1965. You know, this idea that somehow we're very far removed from this and, you know, the sentiments expressed by the current president, Donald Trump, are something new and terrible is actually false.
The context was not domestic racial turbulence. It was geopolitical.
Communist China, the People's Republic of China, had spent a lot of money and time trying to woo African states to its side and using a lot of propaganda to criticize the United States for hypocrisy on civil rights and colonialism. And all of that paid off, and it paid off in part because Nixon and Reagan were incapable of seeing these African nations as states with interests of their own and politics of their own. This idea that only white people are fit for self-government is something that has plagued American democracy since its inception and continues to today.
In The Atlantic this week, you looked at a piece published in Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. Now, Greeley was a Republican, which at the time was the party of Lincoln. And the Democrats were actually the avowed racists. This piece was almost exactly 100 years before the Nixon-Reagan phone call. And the echoes are kind of eerie.
Greeley, who had been a staunch Republican and abolitionist, but who was a conservative, wealthy Northern Republican, his newspaper published an exploration of the Reconstruction government in South Carolina, where at the time, I believe black people had a majority in the state. The article, without fully endorsing racist white Democrats' perception of the Reconstruction government, basically substantiated it by saying that black people were too ignorant, and too debased to really govern the state, and that giving them the vote was a disaster, and that it would be best if the status quo ante returned, where wealthy white men were controlling the state and its politics. And that helped usher in a backlash against Reconstruction in the North, which led to Greeley running against Grant on a platform of ending Reconstruction. And Greeley's doctrine that the government should not interfere on behalf of working people, interfering on behalf of industry, which it had done for a very long time, was perfectly fine, turned that version of the Republican Party towards the one that it became today.
So the party of Lincoln was substantially becoming the party of Greeley, with increasing calls for disenfranchisement of newly enfranchised black voters and the marginalization of freed men. You know, it kind of sounds like the modern day Republican strategy of suppressing the black vote and dismantling what's left of the welfare state. Is it a fair comparison?
I think you can certainly see echoes of that doctrine. You know, one of the things people say is that the parties have switched places, but I would say that it's more accurate to say that who the parties were in the 1870s, they followed their doctrinal beliefs in unexpected directions. So the Republican Party, separated from its working class black base in the South, became much more of a party of capitalism, and the Democrats, who were kind of a party of class war, at least elements of it, were, when black voters joined their coalition, they abandoned their racism and became something else. I think that you can see echoes of this idea that minorities are incapable of sort of objectively evaluating their political choices in rhetoric about black people being on the quote-unquote Democrat plantation. In fact, back in the 1870s, Democratic newspapers were describing black voters as being on the Republican plantation, that the language is almost identical. But this sort of idea that certain voters need to be excluded from the political conversation because they're too unsophisticated or too easily manipulated by so-called free stuff has really been a part of the political conversation for a long time and still is.
So there has been this trend, not just in the United States, of nationalism, nativism, open racism. But this is against the backdrop of a far longer mega trend going back to the post-World War II period of liberal democracy, a trend so pronounced that Francis Fukuyama famously declared the end of history, that the planet was going to be organized along liberal democracy lines and it was all over but the shouting. Well, not quite. But do you believe that what we are witnessing now is in itself a spasm, or do you think it is a competing megatrend that is pitted against the path towards liberalism, and that it is perhaps even more than the Cold War, a battle of ideology that will determine the path of the world? In other words, is this just an ugly temporary phenomenon we're witnessing, or is it something more tectonic?
The United States has essentially always been defined by this conflict between its two faces. One, a country that is defined by its white and Christian origins, and another, a country that is defined by its diversity. Give me, you're tired, you're hungry, you're poor. Anybody can be an American regardless of race, creed, religion. These two impulses that are essentially both forms of nationalist impulses have been competing since the founding. And I think that this is just the latest chapter in that conflict. I'm not sure if that conflict ever gets resolved. The reason I think that we are partially surprised by it is because after the civil rights movement, after the election of Barack Obama, I think people, a bit like Fukuyama's book, had a sense that we had sort of really gotten past this particular battle. And what's happening now is telling us we have not. It's still with us, and we're still going to be fighting it, I suspect, for the rest of my lifetime, if not longer.
Now, I've got to ask you this. From that one phone exchange between Reagan and Nixon, in your piece, you extrapolate a whole narrative of condescension, racism, miscalculation, and cynicism that certainly seems to scan to me. It all makes sense. The dots all seem to connect, but really rests on a thin reed of evidence, which is a snippet of a phone call. is the smoking gun tape finally unearthed at the National Archives, is it enough of a foundation to draw the conclusions you've drawn?
No, it's not, which is why I drew on both of their public records. I mean, Nixon consciously embraced a strategy of white division in order to win the election. His strategists have spoken at length about that. Reagan endorsed in 1964 a candidate who opposed the Civil Rights Act and ultimately the Voting Rights Act, which Reagan did as well. You can see throughout their lives, Nixon and Reagan not just saying offensive things, but taking actions that reflect the worldview that is expressed in that phone call.
And now comes Trump, who is just taking it to a whole new dimension.
Trump is only expressing in public what many, many American presidents believed in private. And I think it's important for Americans to come to terms with that reality because it's the only way to move on and change for the better.
Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Serwer is a staff writer for The Atlantic.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.